The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Now, you mentioned the mini budget. Did you ask yourself, is this politically deliverable?
Yes.
And
yes,
you thought
I
it
did.
Was?
Yes. Well, I don't think it's true that I uprooted the economic architecture.
You suspended the OBR, you'd sacked the Permanent Secretary of the Treasury.
The OBR weren't consulted about furlough announcements. They weren't consulted about public spending announcements. And there were no complaints at the time.
Did you know that your Chancellor was going to promise even more tax cuts?
No.
What did you think when you heard that?
Well, I don't think it was particularly helpful, Fraser.
You also speak in the book about the effect on your family that being in number 10 had.
I was talking to my daughter this morning. She said nothing about this is normal.
Your own husband here warned you this would end in tears.
Yeah, he did.
You didn't listen?
No.
Opinion has been split in immigration amongst Conservatives. In your book, you talk about it as a problem. Have you always believed that the figures were too high?
I agreed with Suella that we needed to reduce them. We've seen the judiciary significantly empowered by Blair's changes to the Constitution. Take the Rwanda policy. It's not deliverable because the courts have stopped it.
So if the courts stop it, it's not deliverable. I mean, you can't wish for a world where the courts don't have these power.
I can wish for a world where the Supreme Court no longer exists. I can. I believe, like you, Fraser, it was possible to change things within the system. And now I'm convinced that the system itself has to change.
It's now 18 months since Liz Truss left number 10, and she's now back with a memoir, 10 Years to Save the West. It's part memoir, part cri de coeur about conservatism, the West, and what we need to do to get out of the mess we're currently in. Liz, welcome, and thank you for joining me on Spectator
TV. Great to be here.
This isn't a conventional memoir, not really. What was your aim in writing it?
See, what I wanted to do is explain what had happened, both in my time as number 10, but also in my career as a minister, but also what's happened for the last 14 years of Conservative government and what's actually been going on since the turn of the millennium. So the most important thing, I think, is to try and say, why are we where we are now? And what do we need to learn as Conservatives? Because the fact is, we haven't been winning the argument. Now, I think there's been a shift to the left, you know, on issues like environmentalism. The extreme environmentalists have got a lot of their own way on the woke agenda. You know, who'd have thought that we'd be talking about whether a man was a man or a woman was a woman? You know, and on the economy, you know, those lessons that we learnt about deregulation, low taxation, controlling the size of the state, we seem to have forgotten those. So my question is, why has that happened? What did I try and do about that? And you know, I talk about why I succeeded in some areas and why I failed in others.
And the subtitle of your book is Lessons from the Only Conservative in the Room. What's that a reference to?
So that's a reference to what I experienced when I met other leaders of the free world, other foreign secretaries of the free world. You know, we've got Biden in the White House, a fairly left-wing Democrat, Trudeau in Canada, Macron in France, Olaf Scholz in Germany. The fact is that the West has been run by the left. And I think that is part of the explanation about why we're seeing an increased lack of self-confidence of the West and increased questioning of ourselves. And I'm talking about my experience of being literally the only conservative in the room at many meetings, actually saying we needed to do things differently.
Well, America's about to go to the polls, and you certainly mentioned America in your book. You say how, as Foreign Secretary, you were lobbying for a forthright position on Ukraine. But you found, when you're writing your speeches, you reveal your suspicion that Joe Biden's administration kept watering them down. What sort of things were you saying that you got the impression that somebody somewhere, perhaps on the other side of the pond, didn't want you saying?
Well, the general concern expressed by, you know, the administration, but also, I think, by the broader foreign policy establishment, was concerns about Russian escalation. So there's been a constant fear throughout the war in Ukraine that if too much was supplied to Ukraine too soon, that that could somehow provoke Russia. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a very dangerous argument, because that argument demonstrates there's some kind of fear of escalation. And of course, the logic of that is you will never challenge any power that is in possession of nuclear weapons. So that was my concern. And the type of thing that I wanted to say, and I still believe, is that Russia must lose this conflict. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not good enough just to say we're going to provide Ukraine with enough weapons to be able to stave off Russian attacks. We actually have to give Ukraine the resources they need to be able to win. And I still think we collectively, and the UK did lead, you know, we did push others into doing things. I'm very proud of that record. But we should have supplied tanks earlier. We should have supplied long-range weapons earlier. We should be providing planes to Ukraine. You know, these are the types of technology that would actually make a difference. And what I was talking about is that broader relationship between officials in the US and in the UK, which the tendency is not to do that and to water things down. So not to say Russia must be defeated.
But let's now talk about Donald Trump, who gets quite a few mentions in your book. And you talk, broadly speaking, favourable mentions. You certainly write as if you think his presidency would be a good thing for America and the world if he were to be re-elected.
I do believe that, yes.
Good for Ukraine?
Yes.
Really? Because his language to Ukraine is very, very different from yours. He talks about it as an encumbrance. He talks about how he would try to fix it in 24 hours. I mean, certainly in Kiev, they think that a Trump presidency would mean pretty much the end to the kind of aid and assistance which they need to win this.
I saw Trump speak when I was at the CPAC conference in DC, which was about a month or two ago. And he was very clear. I think he used the line in his speech that Obama sent pillows and I sent javelins to Ukraine. So Trump did, while Ukraine were facing the threat from Russia, send weapons to Ukraine. What I would say about Donald Trump is judge him on his actions rather than all of the rhetoric. You know, he's a unique style of politician, I think we can say, but I certainly feel, having served as Secretary of State under a Trump administration and under a Biden administration, I think the world was safer when Trump was in charge. And I also think that is true with respect to Iran. I think the Biden administrations have shown weakness on Iran, and that has led to the situation we've seen in the Middle East. So I don't, you know, I'm not going to spend this interview justifying every bit of rhetoric Trump says. But just my own experience of being in government, I felt that the US was a stronger force under Trump.
Right. But you do talk about, when you talk about the West, you're very pro-NATO. You talk about the battle in Ukraine being basically a fight for liberty, which the free world is sharing. Mm. You spoke about the axis of liberty as well when you're foreign secretary. You see a sort of shared alliance here. It just strikes me that this isn't a vision which, put it mildly, is the consensus amongst the American right. You've got many Republicans who think that the Ukraine effort is basically too expensive and should be defunded. You've got Trump himself saying that he would almost be inviting Putin to invade NATO members who don't pay enough money. It just seems to be...
Well, I think he's on a separate occasion said he's 100% committed to NATO. So...
Sure.
As I say, I'm not going to spend the time analysing the rhetoric. What I think is that when Trump was in office, he was more successful at dealing with the authoritarian regimes in the world, namely China, Russia and Iran. I think the current White House has not shown enough strength, in the face of that. And that's not just military strength. It's also economic strength. So, you know, the recent visit by Janet Yellen to China, you know, the cozying up to China, the meetings with American corporates and the Chinese authorities, I worry about that. You know, there is not the moral clarity that there was when President Reagan called out the evil empire. There just isn't. And that is a problem. There's a lack of moral clarity coming from the free world at the moment.
Okay,
and we need to change that.
And you genuinely think Donald Trump is going to restore this moral clarity?
I certainly think he will be a stronger presence than President Biden. Okay. I do.
Now, you've spent a lot of time over there. As you say, you were in CPAC a few weeks ago. One of the things you did there was appear on television with Steve Bannon.
He's like the Fraser Nelson of the US.
Is he really? Is that popular? But, you know, he certainly is a very... well, should we say divisive figure, Steve Bannon? But you were there talking about the deep state, which is a phrase you use a couple of times in the book. Can you say a bit more about the deep state? How do you define it? And do you share Steve Bannon's analysis that the deep state is at work in Britain and in America?
Well, I think what we've seen in both Britain and America, and of course, I've got much more experience of Britain, is the growth of bureaucratic power. So the number of quangos is now more than 500 quangos. They have increasing power. There's generally a lot of mission creep in terms of what they do. And also, I think we've got an increasingly activist civil service as well. So the balance between democratically elected politicians and the administrative state, the quangocracy, the deep state, whatever you want to call it, has shifted significantly, even during the last 14 years. But certainly since the turn of the century. And I think that's a huge problem. I think it's a huge problem for British democracy. It's a problem for getting things done, but it's also a problem of accountability. And so, you can see this, you know, I can list examples of the Post Office, the Bank of England, the Office of Budget Responsibility, Natural England, all of these organisations now wield power that... it's very, very hard for democratically elected politicians to challenge.
Is there anything especially new in this? I mean, you're saying, if I don't misunderstand you, that when you say deep state, effectively you mean the bureaucracy, the blob. People call it various things over the years. But fighting bureaucracy has basically been things conservatives have been complaining about literally for decades. So what's the difference now?
Well, first of all, we've got many more so-called independent agencies.
The quangos.
So,
under Labour, they were proliferating. I mean, the Tories said there was a bonfire in the quangos, which I think was extinguished pretty early on in Cameron's leadership. But again, this is something which has been going back 20, 25 years.
That's right. That's right. And it's no coincidence that Britain's economic growth has not been increasing over the past 25 years. So some of these quangos were set up pre-Blair. Blair turbocharged the quango agenda, and then we've added to it. So gradually, things have got less accountable and more furred up over time. And there are more and more decisions which are now not able to be influenced by ministers. Mm-hmm. And that is a problem if you want to get things done. And of course, my specific experience about, you know, when I was prime minister was the quangos operating in the economic space, namely the Bank of England and the Office of Budget Responsibility. But it is a more general problem across government. And it's not just the growth of quangos and the increased activism within the civil service, which I think is another problem. We've also seen the judiciary significantly empowered by the Blair's changes to the constitution. So all of these things have made it harder for democratically elected politicians to get things done. Take the Rwanda policy, for example, which is being blocked by the courts. Now, I don't think if a British government had tried to enact that policy in the 70s or the 80s, you would have seen the same ability for the legal establishment to thwart that policy.
We didn't have the Human Rights Act. Strasbourg wasn't as dominant. I mean,
correct.
This is...
All of these things have developed over time. But we've now got to a point, in my view, where unless we change the system, which is what I'm advocating in my book, it's very hard for a Conservative government to actually implement Conservative policies. So sometimes people say, well, ex-minister just isn't tough enough, or there's just a lack of political will here. Why is the Prime Minister not doing this? Or why is the Chancellor not doing this? And what I'm saying is, we've now got a system problem. And it has, you know, it's not it's not suddenly appeared. You're right, Fraser. You know, this has been growing for a number of years, but it's also been accompanied by increasing activism within the civil service.
But you talk about democratic accountability. Now, the arguments you're making here were heard a lot 8 years ago in the Brexit referendum. One of the arguments for doing that was, look, we pretend that the House of Commons is in charge of our laws, but when you actually go back and have a look, you'll find out that these are EU directives that we can't really change, that we're stuck in an apparatus that the British people can't vote out. So would you see Brexit as a vote to restore, then, democratic accountability, a vote against the sort of the system, the deep state, call it what you will?
Yes, I would. Yes, I would. And I remember after the Brexit vote, hearing people in my constituency talk about the vote and saying, that was fantastic, we put two fingers up at London. So they weren't just celebrating the fact that we'd left the EU. They also thought it was a strike against the sort of the London bureaucracy or the, you know, London telling them what to do. So it was a general frustration with the way things are and the fact that things seem so hard to change.
But in the book, you write about how you opposed Brexit. You were supporting Remain at the time.
Yeah, I was kind of on the fence at the time, and I spent quite a lot of time thinking about what to do. And my basic logic was that I felt there were all these reasons I went into politics, you know, making Britain competitive again, cutting the size of government, cutting taxes. That was what was a real motivating factor for me. I wanted Britain to be economically successful. I was passionate about education reform. I was an education minister. And I thought, you know, would leaving the EU be taking up time of that agenda? You know, how much could we actually achieve? I don't think as well, I was DEFRA secretary at the time. I don't think as well I'd quite understood how embedded that kind of EU bureaucratic culture was in the Whitehall bureaucratic culture. So what we've effectively done on leaving the EU is expose the fact that Whitehall itself is a unresponsive bureaucracy, whereas previously everybody was able to blame it on the EU, and it's certainly true the EU is an unaccountable bureaucracy. But now
the feelings of a Conservative government now stand exposed. Well, basically, if you don't like immigration, now you can't point to the EU and blame that. The only person you can blame for immigration levels amongst many other things are now those in power in the Conservative
but
government.
I think the decision to leave the European Union was the right decision. And I'm so pleased. I'm pleased that that decision was made, even though I didn't advocate it.
Well, you campaigned against it.
Well, I had to decide which side to be on, and there was a combination of factors.
Sure, but I just put to you that then it could be said that you were part of a deep state, that you were part of the problem to which you now position yourself as a solution.
Well, I'm not positioning myself as a solution, Fraser. I want to highlight here that this is not my bid to become Conservative Party leader or anything like that. I want to explain what happened while I was in government, and therefore, because when I entered Parliament and politics, I didn't appreciate the extent of the power of the bureaucracy.
Now, we're talking about immigration earlier on. In your book, you talk about it as a problem. You say that Suella Braverman, when she was your Home Secretary, was quite right to try to get the numbers below 100,000. But opinion has been split in immigration amongst Conservatives. Some, the economic liberals, have tended to see immigration as a good thing and have tended to be against the limits. I always had you down as one of them. You always struck me as being an economic liberal, somebody more relaxed about higher number of level immigration, and somebody who basically didn't sympathise with the likes of Suella Braverman when she wanted to get the numbers down. Is this something that you've changed your mind on, or have you always believed that the figures are too high?
I've always believed that you can't have uncontrolled immigration.
Yeah, but everybody believes that.
What we're talking about is the number. Mm. And the numbers now are extremely high.
When you were your Prime Minister, did you try to get them reduced? Or because my understanding...
I agreed with Suella that we needed to reduce them. The problem I had was that Suella was saying we need to reduce them to the 100,000. Mm-hmm. They were actually likely to be much higher than that. and the OBR was deliberately costing them at the number Sue Eller had set, which, because of the OBR's poor quality modelling, meant that there was less money in the accounts.
I understand.
I mean, on principle, I believe immigration should be in the sort of 150 to 150,000 mark, but I think we need to be very careful about who we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I believe in favouring high-skilled workers. I think we allow too many student visas. I think we allow too much chain immigration and family dependence. So I would want to change the mix of immigration and have it much lower. I faced a practical problem, which is all wrapped up in the whole mini budget issue, which was the OBR was taking Suella's ambitions, which frankly were not going to happen in the next 2 years.
You mean the ambition of tens of thousands? That was her ambition.
Yeah, exactly. They were taking that as that would be the reality. Mm-hmm. That just simply wasn't true.
Right.
Plus, I didn't agree with her economic model anyway. I mean, it was a...
I'm with you, but you're
saying that... It's a bizarre web of problems.
But this
problems.
Was the hand that you were dealt by the OBR.
Yeah.
Now, are you saying that given the hand you were dealt, you had to say...
Well, first of all, the mini-budget was done without an OBR forecast. Mm-hmm. So this was post-mini-budget, post the Bank of England, you know, not sorting out the LDI crisis. You know, we ended up in a very, very difficult position. So right. that was a question of firefighting in what was a very difficult position.
Right, but at the time, didn't you oppose Suella Braverman's attempt to go down to 10,000
for
the reasons
I didn't.
That you mentioned?
No, what I was concerned about is rhetoric being used to feed into the OBR forecast. Mm-hmm. I was very supportive of increasing the salary threshold and also reducing the number of foreign dependents for students, because I think that route is being completely exploited. So I was supportive of the policy measures. The issue was the rhetoric compared to what was actually happening. Mm-hmm. And basically we would be taking economic pain for something that wasn't happening.
Now, you mentioned the mini budgets.
I mean, it's so complicated, the relationship between migration, the OBR, and
the budget. Yeah, but to be honest, you could simplify it this way by saying that the OBR basically say X money more net migration means X more GDP. X more GDP means that you as Prime Minister will have more money to spend either on tax cuts or extra public spending. Therefore, you've got an incentive to want higher rather than lower net migration.
But so I don't agree with the OBR's reckonings.
Right, but so you still felt you had to go along because that was the way the system works. Your book is all about the system, how it works and how it doesn't.
But the point is that I don't agree with the OBR forecasting methods. I think the OBR should be abolished. I think it's been detrimental to British policy because essentially tax policy is now being run by a arm's length body, not by the Chancellor. I think that's a huge problem. But what I did want to crack down on student visas, chain immigration, and raise the salary threshold. And we were absolutely planning to do that. The point is, what I didn't want is the OBR reflecting something that wasn't going to happen in their figures.
Well, look, you mentioned the OBR. I think you mentioned the OBR in this book almost as much as you mentioned Donald Trump. I think they're both the number one mentions you get.
I don't think that's true, actually.
I counted. They're both 40 times. But the OBR is a big part of your story, isn't it? Because now this might sound incredibly nerdy. God knows what American readers will think of it. But the point you want to make is that from the outside, it seems as if a prime minister is in number 10 and can do anything he or she wants. In effect, you've got this outside organization which is judging every policy you want to do. And it doesn't exactly give you a thumbs up or a thumbs down, but it tells you how much it's going to cost. So if you want to come up with a policy and you think it's going to cost not very much, and the OBR says, no, that will cost a lot of money, then that's it. It has to fall. So you could give several examples in the book of how the OBR's costing has come to take on way more power than it was ever intended. But I wonder if the OBR really only has as much power as a prime minister wants to give it, because nothing forces you, nothing obliges you. You could, if you
but
don't
can
like
you
the
imagine,
OBRs, you can get somebody
but
else.
But the problem is that the OBR has now been set in legislation. So it's been set in legislation as the official forecast of the government. when I got there, the Treasury didn't have the skills or capability to actually do forecasting. And building an economic model takes quite a long time, Fraser. We could have been waiting a year before we put a forecast out. That's the reality of where I was in 2022. So there wasn't a possibility of coming up with an economic model. And can you imagine if I'd said, okay, we've got the OBR here. These are the official forecasters that the government has legislated for, that, you know, a conservative minister has appointed the head of the OBR. Here's their forecast over here. But no, I'm going to go and get, you know, my mate in the city to do an alternative forecast. Can you imagine how that would have been viewed?
Well, I'm wondering if you did imagine how
I did.
Did you really? Because it seems to me as if what you did was you basically changed the Permanent Secretary of Treasury. You sent the OBR away. You didn't quite wonder how all this would play out, which...
Well, I did wonder that.
Right. But you... So did you think it would work, though? Did you... Because you would have had to ask yourself, sure, this is what I want to do. These are the forces ranged against me, the Treasury, the Bank of England, the OBR. Did you ask yourself, is this politically deliverable?
Yes.
And
yes,
you thought
I
it
did.
Was?
Yes.
Why did you think it was?
Well, what I thought was that the furlough scheme had been announced without any OBR forecast. It was what I was announcing was smaller than that.
It was a feral whack. You wanted to borrow £30 billion to subsidise people's energy bills. £30 billion.
Well, that was one of the policies that didn't get reversed, by the way.
Sure, but you wanted to borrow...
It was the
borrow.
Tax policies.
You were tapping the markets for a staggering amount of money. But when you read this book, when you listen to your accounts of Number 10, you talk as if your agenda was to massively cut taxes. In fact, sure, there were tax cuts there, but the bulk of it was to borrow and spend to subsidise energy prices. And that really what wasn't did you. You used Thatcherite language, but a large part of you was spending like...
I don't
like
think that's true, because if you look at what policy I was forced to reverse when... And this is the point, the OBR leaked... And this is why the OBR is powerful. The OBR leaked a £70 billion hole in the finances, which turned out not to be true. And I was forced to reverse the corporation tax rise. So I wasn't forced to reverse the energy policy. That was generally accepted. And I just think, frankly, politically, we had to do something at the time. I'm afraid I had to make compromises. But I was not forced to reverse that. We were forced to reserve the corporation tax. And my contention is that if we'd kept corporation tax at 19% and we'd done things, and I did have spending reductions planned, which were things like not raising welfare by prices, raising it by wages instead, holding down spending. If we'd kept all those things in place, I think the economy would be in a better position now. But I was not forced... The energy policy was not the thing we were forced to reverse, which is my point about what the real views are of the Bank of England and the OBR. It wasn't the energy policy they were objecting to, it was the tax policy. And that's why I think it is important to recognise what they did, leaking that number, and then the policy that we were actually forced to reverse.
But isn't this a wee bit conspiratorial? I mean, the OBR wasn't the only economic forecaster in Britain. There were so many of them coming out with the estimates for the whole totality of your package, the tax cuts, but also the massive borrow and spend. So there were lots of people saying, look, this new prime minister is just, by the way, uprooted lots of the economic architecture at the same time as making a massive demand on world
markets.
Well,
I don't think it's true that I uprooted the economic architecture.
You suspended the OBR, you'd sacked the permanent secretary of the Treasury.
As I said, the OBR weren't consulted about furlough announcements. They weren't consulted about public spending announcements. And there were no complaints at the time.
But this was a mini-budget, and under the mini-budget, you'd expect the OBR to be asked to give commentary, as it always has done. You suspended them. Now, that was your decision, but I'm just saying that you combined this radicalism. By the way, how many other new prime ministers have fired the permanent secretary of the Treasury? None. You were doing things that had never been done before at a time where you were asking incredibly jittering markets to lend you staggering amounts of money, and it was the markets, not the deep state, that looked at you and thought, nah.
Well, I think the one bold thing we did was the permanent secretary of the Treasury. But I felt that, you know, the people in charge of these organisations had basically been responsible for economic policy that hadn't worked for 20 years. And in order to change that policy, we had to do it. I think it was the political reality that we had to do an energy package at the time. That was just the political reality.
And you say in your book you couldn't even get the new economic permanent secretary that you wanted, that you say that, that you had wanted to, you know, somebody in mind, another permanent secretary, but that was blocked.
Yes.
Right. Is that significant?
Well, I think it is. I think it's a really important principle that ministers, the Chancellor, the Prime Minister, should be able to have a say over the senior officials that work for them. And the fact it was so controversial that a senior official was replaced is a huge problem.
Isn't that because of the tradition of an independent civil service whose permanent secretaries, clues in the name, are not replaced by new prime ministers?
Well, this is what I'm questioning, Fraser. I'm questioning, does that system actually work? I think you should do a penance of working in government for 2 years, Fraser,
you know,
and then
I'd
you
love
will
to.
Understand.
I would really love to
well,
do.
There's
you
a
know,
job
I'd love to be the Prime Minister's policy decisions, but I can see for myself why none of this can work. You know, by the way, I think it's a really interesting thing. You always sitting outside, you think, God, if only I was Prime Minister, I could
exactly.
do this. And this book tells
this
you.
This is exactly what my thought is. Mm. This is what I'm trying to say to you, that you know, I believed it was possible. I believe, like you, Fraser, it was possible to change things within the system. And now I'm convinced that the system itself has to change. And it's through bitter experience.
On that system, you give a fascinating account of the mini budgets, and you reveal that you basically abandoned your economic strategy after a written warning from Simon Case, the cabinet secretary, that unless you did so, the economy would melt down. Now, can you...
It's not the economy would melt down, just to be clear. It's that we would no longer be able to fund government debt. That's the important
point. Well,
you
call it saying, if I refuse to change course, the financial catastrophe they predicted would undoubtedly occur. So you were told that there would
be a
financial catastrophe mm-hmm. unless you changed course. But can you say a bit about the significance of receiving a letter like that from the head of the civil service? Because a lot of people who don't really follow government won't quite clock the significance of that.
Well, it was very serious, because a lot of people I've spoken to since say, Liz, why didn't you stick to your guns? You know, why didn't you carry on with the policies, which you know, I still believe are right, the right policies, as discussed. And I said I was, you know, given a warning that if I continued with those policies, that would be the consequence. And I couldn't, in all conscience, put the country in that position. That's why I reversed the policies, and I thought it was a credible threat.
Right, but you say in your book that you believe that if you refuse to change course, then the catastrophe would undoubtedly occur. So you basically...
Well, not undoubtedly. I mean, maybe I've written that in my book. I mean, I just thought that I couldn't risk it.
Right. I'm with you, but it seems from reading it that you basically did think that that you didn't have any other option, that you basically lost on too many fronts. So did you know that your Chancellor was going to go into Sky on the Sunday and basically promise even more tax cuts?
No.
Were you quite surprised when you found that out?
The point about the... The warning, that was after.
Yeah, this was a few days after.
A few days later. Mm-hmm. So no, I didn't know that.
Right. And what did you think when you heard that?
Well, I don't think it was particularly helpful, Fraser.
It was a rather delicate time. You also say you went off to Washington and you advised him not to.
That's also true, yes.
Why do you think he should have stayed?
Because I thought the situation was very serious. And I'd seen him on the Monday. I mean, it became... So after the... mini budget, the growth plan, things were like relatively calm in my view on the Friday and Saturday. Mm-hmm. And it was only on the Monday morning that I was mm-hmm. alerted to there was a serious problem. And this is where I was alerted to the whole LDI issue, mm-hmm. which was essentially a tinderbox. You know, the UK had 60% of the world's LDIs. We were very exposed to small changes in the rate, much more than other economies, which I hadn't been aware of. And mm-hmm. of course, that was very concerning. But so I thought Kwasi should have stayed in the country, yes.
You also speak in the book about the effect on your family that being a number 10 had. You say that most children find out about the fallibilities of their parents over a number of years. Mine saw all of my fallibilities exposed in very short order. Now, that's an interesting dimension. It's one of several personal reflections in your book here. But so do you think you underestimated the effect it would have, those 44 days would have? Because you've been at...
Well, I didn't know it was going to be 44 days at the time. But wait, I think it was 49, actually,
you'd
technically.
You've been in cabinet, then you've been a foreign secretary. Yeah, yeah. You've done a lot of high-profile jobs. You might have thought that you had a pretty good idea of the difference it would make in your family.
It's just
life.
A completely different level. So even as foreign secretary, you know, I had a protection team. You can pretty much wander around unnoticed, actually. It's possible to live a normal life as a senior girl, relatively normal. I was talking to my daughter this morning. She said nothing about this is normal, but anyway. It's possible to live a sort of relatively normal life, whereas, you know, and the whole, you know, running for the leadership was quite a sudden decision because of the nature of Boris's defenestration. You know, I was in Indonesia at the time. So there wasn't really much time to talk about any of it. It was...
Really? Because for a long, long time, you were number one of the bookmakers saying who's going to be the next prime minister. You were number one of the Conservative Home Charts. You couldn't move in Tory party conference for people coming to Liz Truss rallies. The idea of you being the next prime minister was hardly fanciful. People were speaking about it all the time. I find it hard to believe your own family didn't discuss that.
But you have... First of all, I didn't think Boris would go. I thought it was crazy to get rid of him,
well,
but I didn't think...
Really, it was hardly... everybody was talking about
I know,
how long
but
he
by,
on for. He
by,
was on a thread for a very long time before that thread
How
slipped.
Long do you think the thread was?
How long do you think
the... Yeah, no, but how long do you think it was seriously in prospect that he was going to go?
For at least 6 months.
So... But if you think about it, by then, I was just completely embroiled in the Ukraine situation. Like, I'd been... Like Christmas sort of 2021-2, it was just constant Ukraine. I'd spent the whole of the half term going in to deal with Ukraine. I was not really, I was kind of aware of it, don't get me wrong, but I wasn't spending 24 hours a day talking or thinking about it. I was thinking about how on earth do we get more weapons to Ukraine? What do we do about sanctions? That was what was on my mind.
Really? So you didn't have a sort of family confab and think, look, if the ball would come loose from the scrum, to use a Boris metaphor.
That sounds very Boris.
Exactly. But then, you know, doesn't every politician go into the House of Commons thinking, like, would I like to be Prime Minister? Could I be? If you're Foreign Secretary...
I was really hoping it wouldn't happen. I was hoping Boris would stay.
Right.
So...
But you say your own husband here warned you this would end in tears.
Yeah, he did.
Didn't listen.
No. Well, I kind of did listen. He sort of said I had to go for it, but it would end in tears. So.
Right.
A bit like a sort of Cassandra figure.
Right. And you say that during the leadership bids, that showed that party members had, in your words, rejected technocracy. Is that what they've ended up with now?
Well, I think the reality of the situation now is that, you know, we haven't been able to change things enough.
Would you describe it as a technocracy?
Well, I've just been talking about who is running the country, and yes, there's far too much power in the hands of people who aren't elected.
Right.
And that is the definition of a technocracy.
Right. But
you know, who is setting economic policy? I would argue it's Richard Hughes and Andrew Bailey.
Right.
I guess that is the definition of a technocracy, and I think the public, I want to use the book to explain that that is what is happening and that I think things need to change. Because right. I think the public expect politicians to be able to change things. And if they can't, you know, if we can't get the flights off to Rwanda because of the courts, if we can't cut taxes, well, you say the promise shouldn't be made. I think we've got to...
It's not deliverable.
I think it is deliverable practically. It's not deliverable because the courts have stopped it.
So if the courts stop it, it's not deliverable. I mean, you can't wish for a world where the courts don't have this power. And
I can wish for a world where the Supreme Court no longer exists. I can.
Right.
And I do wish for that world.
But you couldn't wish for a world where your tax agenda could have been delivered in the time frame that you put it over, because there were too many obstacles that you didn't quite pay attention to, like the rising bond markets, the political deliverability. You said in your book here that this didn't happen because not enough Conservatives wanted it to happen. Your own party wouldn't back you. Now, you can't really blame them for it, because as a leader, you need to work out what's practical and what's not. So again, it seems
but
to
then
me...
Then it sort of exposes the question, Fraser, of I believe fervently in these policies. I believe they were the right policies. And I believe that if those policies had stayed in place, the Conservative Party would be in a better position than it is now. Did I know that, you know, some of my colleagues would so vociferously object to them? No, I didn't. I believed that I'd won a mandate in the leadership election. I believe that I was delivering on what we'd actually said in our 2019 manifesto.
To cancel the corporation tax.
I did successfully reverse the new health and social care levy. Mm-hmm. So I did, in my time in office, get rid of an entire new tax, of which I'm very proud.
Which you said you would do, but take the 45p tax. You didn't even tell your own cabinet in the morning of the mini budget that you'd do that. Why not?
Because of leaks. You know, it's very common not to tell, I'm afraid, people in government the absolute details of budgets because they leak.
Absolutely, but that was
and
rather...
maybe, and I regret that we've now moved to a system where the entire budget seems to be leaked the week before. I don't think that's right.
But you needed to take people with you. You needed to take your own cabinet with you. If you couldn't trust your own cabinet with this information, then how could you really expect them to
I
back
can
you
tell
or be surprised
you,
when they don't?
I can tell you that I've spent 10 years, or no, 8 years as a cabinet minister, and I've been at no budget meeting where the entire details of the budget were revealed.
Not the entire, but abolishing the 45p tax. Would you say that's in the top five measures, top three?
Well, it's certainly not in cost terms, no.
No, but in terms of political significance.
It costs virtually nothing.
In political significance, I put it to you that you're not quite as surprised as you make out you are in the book as to why so few Conservatives went along with you, because this isn't about economics, this is about the message it sends. Was this the right time to be cutting the tax for the very richest? You're a politician. You know how hard it is to sell the argument.
But this
you
is...
know your colleagues would think, look, Liz, in a perfect world, we would like to cut this tax, but right now, we, the Conservative Party, cannot do it at a time of massive austerity.
Well, it's not a time of massive austerity. The government is spending 45% of GDP.
But if you look at the cost of living pressures, then, shall we say?
This is the... If we're never prepared to make conservative arguments, Fraser, if we're never prepared to say, what's the point of having a tax rate that's raising no money and is actively encouraging people to relocate out of Britain, what's the point of being a conservative?
You need to pick your timing, Nigel Lawson took the top rate down, he chose his timing. You could have chosen
But we
yours.
Didn't have time. You know, the way I saw it is that we needed to get the economy growing. We need to do everything we could to show that Britain was open for business, to encourage people to invest in our country. And if we didn't do that, we'd be facing a very difficult situation of stagnation and rising costs. And that is exactly what I said during the leadership election. It's what I tried to deliver in government. And, you know, you're absolutely right. Not enough people supported it. But you know, the alternative was doing, you know, not doing anything. And I didn't run to be prime minister not to do anything.
Right. Let's look at a counterfactual. So you're sitting there in number 10. Antonia Romeo is a Treasury permanent secretary, your first choice. And she is saying to you, Prime Minister, look at the global bond markets are spiking. By the way, there's a massive pensions crisis. Now is not the time to do your mini budget. You just said you wouldn't have done it had you been properly warned about the risks. So if you had better chosen the timing, if you had corrected some of the mistakes that you say here, whether it be pitch ruling, which is one of the few mistakes that you recognise, or whether it was doing the spending cuts at the same time as the tax cuts, if you had done it another way and you were still number 10 now...
I don't think there was another way, by the way,
really?
Fraser, because if you look at the fact that the OBR was predicting a £70 billion hole, none of those things would have been able to happen.
But you didn't need to announce... You say you wouldn't have announced your mini-budget had you known at the start...
I wouldn't have announced it then.
Right.
I would have... You know, in an ideal world, I think what we would have done is Andrew Bailey should have sorted out the LDI situation and unwound the LDI situation. So if I'd known that the LDI situation was there as a massive iceberg on the horizon, of course I wouldn't have driven the vessel into it.
But that's you what know, I'm asking you.
But so
what would have happened if Antonio Ramon had said, look, there's the iceberg, we can avoid it now, what would have happened?
So what should have happened is the LDI. So it's what the Bank of England governor should have done differently that's
and
the
had,
issue.
And had that happened, what would you have done differently? If this had been dealt with in a good time?
So if...
What is the counterfactual?
What is the counterfactual?
The counterfactual so, whereby you're still number 10 right now.
I think it's an unlikely counterfactual, but I will go along with it.
Were you doomed anyway? Is that what you're saying?
I think it's an unlikely counterfactual. But if the LDI situation had been unwound, I think we would have still had the problem of the ABR. I may have done things differently, appointed different people, magicked up better media strategy, whatever. There's plenty of counterfactuals like that. But I don't think any of them would have changed the fundamentals because, as I've said, a combination of the actions of the Bank of England, the actions in the ABR make it very, very difficult to pursue a conservative economic policy.
Well, let's talk about the future.
Because they don't believe in the Laffer curve and the supply side. That's the bottom line.
You launched the Popular Conservatives with Lee Anderson. Was it a mistake to kick him out of the party?
I think it would be better if he was still a member of the Conservative Party, yes.
Right, but you must look at what's happening. You see a split in the right now. That's what we can see. The Reform has got about 15% of the polls. A lot of people who would have voted for Conservatives, about half of them who did vote in 2019, aren't voting now. What's happening with the right in Britain right now? Is it splitting in two?
Well, what is happening is people are frustrated that the policies being pursued aren't sufficiently changing the country. People voted for change in 2016 and they voted for change in 2019 and there hasn't been enough change.
So how is this going to end? I mean, do you think we're going to end up with a Canada situation where the Conservatives...
I don't think that, no. I don't think that. No. Because, I want the Conservatives to do as well as possible the election, just to be clear. I think Keir Starmer would turbocharge the administrative state and do all sorts of dreadful things. I want the Conservatives to win. I want us to have more robust policies on everything from tax to net zero to immigration, wokery, etc. So I want us to have all those robust policies, but I absolutely don't, So I think that's the direction we need to go in. And I think Reform has emerged because we're not being clear enough about that and we're not doing those things.
Do you see yourself now as a kind of transatlantic figure? I mean, reading this book, 10 Years to Save the West, basically this is half-pitched at an American audience, it seems to me.
Well, I'm publishing it in the US as well.
Right.
People can order it on my website there. So.
But those people will be in America. This is how.
Because I think America faces a lot of the same problems. I think America faces institutions and a media class that has moved to the left. They've moved to the left on issues like transgender. They've moved to the left on issues like net zero. They've moved to the left on immigration. And they've moved to the left on the economy. So the economic tenets I believe in, the sort of the Friedmanite worldview, if you like, has become unfashionable. It's become unfashionable in the UK and it's unfashionable in the US. And this is why I think as well as what we need to do to reform the way the state works, we also need to have a revival of arguments about conservative principles. And this is, back to the 45p tax rate. I mean, if we're never prepared to argue that taxing high earners and too much is a bad thing, then why are we here? I feel just an intense frustration that too many people who are conservatives are not prepared to argue for conservative policies. And all it means is we're constantly shifting ground to the left and we're basically appeasing the left. And that's what frustrates me.
And are you at risk now of importing some American language from the American half of your audience here? I mean, nobody talks about the deep state in this. Nobody sane talks about the deep state in Britain anyway.
Well, Well, I was in America talking to an American audience about what I meant by the Quangocracy. And nobody in America knows what a Quango is. So I was trying to explain it to an American audience. But I think there is a problem with unaccountable bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. And I think that problem has got worse. And I think unless conservatives and conservative-leaning journalists like you, Fraser, actually, you know, I want people to understand the nature of the problem. Because what we're doing at the moment, you know, clearly democratically elected politicians are being thwarted in their efforts by unelected officials.
And the C. Kwasi Kwarteng gets a mention for having read through the book here. Are you
I don't know. I don't think he's read the whole book.
Right. But, you know, you sort of acknowledge him. Are you guys back on speaking terms now?
We were never not on speaking terms,
were you? I'm sure there was a little difficult period after you fired him where he wasn't talking to you for a while.
I don't think that's true, but okay.
Okay, and what is next for you then? Are you going to do, you're going to promote the book? Can we expect a sort of joint Steve Bannon podcast or something like that?
Well, you know, I don't know if I'll appear with your American counterpart, Fraser, might do. I'm obviously very interested in the whole issue of how we get the economy growing. That's what the Growth Commission is about. We've launched the Popcom movement, which is about trying to get more grassroots support for change. Because people want to see the end results of the policy, but I think we need to talk more about how we're going to deliver that policy. So that's what I'm
And what's the difference what between the Popcom movement and reform?
Well, the Popcom movement is a group of conservatives who want to change.
But agenda-wise, it's the
change.
Same, isn't it? The Popcom has been a success. It just is led by Richard Tice, and it's about to sink the Tories up next election.
This is about the making the argument and the intellectual case and having... The left has become a powerful force. Mm-hmm. And it has swayed our institutions. If you look at the National Health Service talking about chest feeding or, you know, what's going on in our organisations with, you know, respect to net zero or, you know, the DEI agenda. The fact is the left have been very successful agitating at a grassroots level to change things in their direction. So even though we've got a Conservative government, you found a lot of our institutions are shifting to the left. What Popcon is consciously about is trying to shift things the other way.
And this book reads a little bit like a pre-mortem, shall we say, rather than a post-mortem. The reasons that the Tories are about to fail. Would that be a fair assessment?
It's a book where I've sort of put all my thoughts into. And people can read it as they want. But I wanted to explain, you know, because a lot of people ask me, you know, what happened, you know, what thought process did you go through? And I just wanted to explain that. And I wanted to share what it's like being on the inside. Because I'm a sort of, I sometimes feel like a bit of an outsider insider, which is I'm not from the establishment. I believed I could achieve things through the system. I got increasingly frustrated through the system. And I found even at the top, it wasn't delivering.
Okay, well, thank you for the sharing thoughts on Spectator TV.
Thank you.